in consultation with Josh and with Laura, we had discussion about what would be the best way to make use of the precious time that we have today. And, of course, we want to introduce Shin Buddhism to you, for those of you who don't have that background. And, of course, those from Buddhist Faith Fellowship have extensive background in Shin Buddhism. And also how Shin Buddhism, the Shin tradition and the Zen tradition might interface, might complement each other, how they resonate with each other, so on and so forth. And I think maybe the easiest way for me to begin is really to say something about my own background. So as Jesso generously introduced me, and he also introduced the fact that I of course, as a scholar, as well as in my capacity as a priest, I've written about Buddhism. Well, a lot of these publications wouldn't have happened without Josh, because he's my editor. Anyway, to be more serious. So, Buddhism has a long and illustrious history in my own family. In fact, I'm the 14th generation ordained priest in my family. So Japan is a little bit of an exception when it comes to Buddhist cultures, because Japanese Buddhism generally, and especially Shin tradition, is especially the temples are handed down father to son. So it may be one of, if not the only, Buddhist culture in which that's a regular practice. And that's because Japanese Buddhism, especially Shin tradition, is not a celibate tradition. It's a family tradition. But even then, even though we have that, for example, Protestant ministers are married and so on and so forth, the church, well, sometimes the son will take over, but more often than not, that's not the case, right? But in Japanese Buddhism and in Shin tradition, that's been the case. So for 14 generations, the oldest male unno, it's just a custom, has handed down the abbotship of the temple to the next generation eldest son. I'm the only son, so for 14 generations, approximately 400 years, that's my tradition. And my grandfather first came to this country as a Buddhist priest, and my father was also ordained, and now I'm following their footsteps. I don't have any children, so all I can do is just look at my little cat, Onyx, and say, Onyx, you be the next one. In any case, little Onyx actually just passed away last year, so we don't even have the cat to pass the Dharma lineage onto. But on the one hand, I come from 14 generations of Buddhist priests, and so I felt a great responsibility for carrying on that tradition. On the other hand, it was my conscious choice and decision, especially being raised in our culture, American culture, to choose to study Buddhism, to become ordained as a priest, and also to become a scholar. And I think that it may be helpful to say something about the origins of Buddhism in our family in terms of what Buddhist tradition is and isn't, which is that originally the Unno clan was not, obviously our family didn't start 400 years ago, so you could just go back further and further. Originally, the Unno clan was a warrior clan in the northern part of the main island of Japan called Honshu. And approximately 400 years ago, in the feudal period, unfortunately, we chose the wrong side. And as a warrior on the losing side, you have two choices. You can either honorably commit ritual suicide, right, called harakiri or seppuku. It's very gory. You show your courage as a warrior by cutting your abdomen open and then pulling your entrails out, pulling your intestines out. Intense pain, you can just imagine. Well, just even the sight of it made my forebears faint, so they said, that's not for us. We'll take option B. And option B was to run as fast and as far away as you could and take the tonsure and become a Buddhist priest, because that way you're no longer a military threat and you're not a political or economic threat, right? Because you're taking vows of renunciation. So So being the courageous warriors they were, they said, we'll take option B. And went all the way to the southernmost large island called Kyushu. And that's where my forebears had been Buddhist priests for 12 generations until my grandfather decided to come to this country. And then we ended up staying here. But something changed along the way. Something changed along the way that I don't know how far back it goes, but my own memory goes back as far as my great-grandmother, who was the temple wife in the temple on my father's mother's side. So there are stories about my father's father's side, but on my father's mother's side, my great-grandmother was married into a Shin Buddhist temple. And she was probably a teenager. It was typical custom. So she was probably 17 or 18 when she was married into the temple. She might have even been 16. and following the customary practice, gave greetings to all of the relatives on the husband's side. And when they went to, the newlywed couple went to give greetings to one of my great-grandfather's aunts, the first thing she said when she opened the door to welcome them, she said in Japanese, "Goshoma no ichidaiji wa kaiketsu saremashita ka?" Which roughly translates to, have you resolved the problem of life and death? So on the one hand, 16, 17-year-old young girl, she has no idea what does this mean. But the other hand, is she's very pure, being a young woman. And she's, the term that's used for the wife of a temple priest is bomori, which literally means temple protector. So it's a very important position. And she's thinking, I'm going to become the bomori, the temple protector of my husband's temple, but I have no idea what this means. So fire was lit under her, and she thought, I have to realize the truth beyond life and death. Whatever that is. So, you know, she was very busy, she became pregnant, she had children, so on and so forth. And she was really looking forward to listening to my great-grandfather's sermons so that she could hear the Dharma and to learn the Dharma. But he was, by reputation, I never met him because he had passed, but I have met my great-grandmother. She was still alive. He was a typical, what we call Kyushu Danji, typical Kyushu man, very male chauvinist. So when she said, I'm really looking forward to listening to your sermons, he says, no, a woman's place is in the kitchen, preparing tea and refreshments for all of the members. So he wouldn't even let her listen to the teachings. Right? But she felt, but I have to understand. So right at that time, their temple was not very far away from the main station in Fukuoka, which is the largest city in the island of Kyushu. There was another temple right near the central station. And there was a very famous Shin priest named Kichiri Wajo. And he gave sermons every morning, Dharma talks every morning at like 4:30 in the morning for commuters. So she would wake up very early at like 3:30, and because she had to take care of the children, she would dress the toddlers, including my grandmother, and take them with her and listen to the teachings. And this wasn't like a lecture where you get information. No, it was just a delivery of the Dharma itself. And then she would go home, put the kids to bed, make breakfast. And then her husband, oh, where's my breakfast? And this went on for many years without him even knowing. And eventually, more and more people came to this temple, became members of this temple. But they didn't come to hear him give his Dharma talks, even though he was actually very well known as a very good preacher. They didn't come to hear his Dharma talks. No, they just came to sit by my great-grandmother and just to be with her. Yeah. And she was a tiny, tiny woman. She was probably all of 80 pounds, if that. And she was like 4'8", just tiny, tiny, but she just packed a wallop. Yeah, I still remember, you know, being with her, and I was just a toddler. I was born in Los Angeles, but we moved to Japan when I was 2 because my father was finishing his graduate studies in Japan, and we went to visit them, and I was so blessed that I got to see her while she was still alive, and it was the one and only time. And I was like 2 years old, and I just followed her around saying, Nammanda, Nammanda. So I don't know if it's with her generation, but it must be earlier because her aunt had this great spiritual power to be able to ask my great-grandmother this question. So somewhere we stopped being cowardly, defeated samurai warriors, and there emerged within the Unno clan a seeker of the Dharma. So just having, you know, the tradition handed down in and of itself means nothing. There has to be a moment of decision in each person. And I had my moment of decision also, which for me occurred in my early 20s when I realized I was so profoundly lost and confused about everything. You know, by the time I came to the end of 4 years in college, I thought, Mark, you could barely flush the toilet. What are you going to do when you get out in the world? I was just talking with Laura and Steve yesterday, but, you know, I could do one thing by the end of college and nothing else, and that's that I could write papers in my field of religious studies, yeah. But I was really kind of messed up. So that's when my real quest began, my real search. So this is the other side. It has nothing to do with Buddhism. But what I was looking for was not Buddhism. No. It was different, and I can't compare myself to my great-grandmother. But in my own way, I faced a moment of life and death struggle. And I had to... I realized I needed to find a way, a path, a way to figure out who am I and how do I live this human life. So many of you know that Buddhism, especially Mahayana Buddhism, has the teaching of upaya, that all of the practices and all of the teachings are upaya, skillful means. They're not so much ends in themselves, but they are vehicles for self-realization. And this really applies in my case. It's really the question of how do I live this human existence, which is a question everybody has, especially, you know, when I was in my early 20s and facing different possibilities, but also issues and problems. So I always like to begin there, is Buddhism, Buddhist practice, being a Buddhist is not about Buddhism, Buddhist practice, being a Buddhist. But Buddhism is a vehicle for me to go deeper into the question of my own existence. And we can formulate that any number of ways. Who am I, really? Where did I come from? And where am I going? And when I think about that kind of question, there's a lot of different ways to think about it. I mean, we have dreams, you know. I still have many dreams. Dreams of career, dreams of relationship, dreams of family, dreams of, you know, of owning a home, of visiting places, all these kind of things. And we want to realize these things. We want to realize, we want to help those that we love and care about to have these experiences, to realize their dreams. And we think that's what human life is all about, to go for your dreams, to realize your dreams. And that's certainly true. But from early enough in my life, in my early 20s, I realized there's other stuff that I messed up, that I'm confused, that I'm not successful. When I as a college student, I did well in school and I wrote a graduation thesis and I did very well on it. But I wasn't smart enough. I knew that I was not ready to go on to do any kind of graduate study. And I had friends who were brilliant. So I was very close friends, still am friends with a man named Tom Frieden. And he also did his senior honors thesis. I was in religion, he was in philosophy, but we were both philosophers of religion, as it were. And he did his on Wittgenstein, a great Austrian philosopher, and it was absolutely brilliant. And he immediately went on to medical school, Columbia Medical School, and then he just kept going. And now he is the director of the Center for Disease Control, appointed by Obama. So that's who's responsible for these commercials that show what happens when you smoke too much, because that's one of his big campaigns. I knew I couldn't do that. I was not going to get into a good PhD program, or probably any PhD program. So yeah, I could write a college level paper, but not good enough. And so I was very lost, very confused. But one of the things I realized at that point was, you know what? Lots of people experience confusion. Lots of people face difficulties of all different kinds, emotional, physical, mental, financial, social. You know, right now I teach at the University of Oregon, and they just completed renovations on the football facilities, the training facilities. Holy cow, we're not even allowed in there. And you know, it's like a $150 million facility. They recruit the best athletes. They have a dedicated academic support facility just for NCAA Division I athletes. It's a giant cube. It's like a five-story giant cube made completely out of glass. And general people are only allowed in to the main lobby where there's a coffee shop. If you go further in, you can see there's a light board and two student workers. And it has a list of all the athletes, all their tutors, and all their appointments. Tremendous facility. But of all these hundreds of NCAA Division I athletes that we have at the University of Oregon, how many are going to go on to a successful professional career? Right? Maybe three or four out of hundreds. So if they aspire to a professional athletic career, they're going to fail. Odds are they're going to fail. And even of those who succeed, what's the standard? Win the Super Bowl. How many are going to win the Super Bowl? Probably none. And yet every year, you know, whether it's the Patriots, I'm still a Patriots fan. I lived in Massachusetts my teenage years. Go Patriots. Red Sox did well this year. Right? But it's like every year, it's like a failure. Why? Because the Patriots didn't win the Super Bowl. Expectations are so high. So at that early stage, in addition to the mental, emotional turmoil of being totally confused, what can I do, what can I be, who am I really? One incipient insight I had was, whatever it is, Mark, that you're going to do, you're going to be, to truly be yourself, it has to incorporate all of life. So-called successes and so-called failures. The happy times and the bad times. Tears of laughter, but also tears of sorrow. And although I've gained so much from so many different paths and philosophies and religions, Buddhism, and in particular Shin Buddhism, became the greatest vehicle for me to be able to realize all of who I am, the things I like about myself, and the things I don't like about myself. That deeper down, there is a drive, there is an unfolding to embrace and to be embraced for all of who I am. This has been a very, very busy month for me. Earlier this month, I traveled to Seattle, where I have a good friend, Jason Wirth, who teaches at Seattle University and who is a practicing Zen Buddhist. He has his own sangha, the Eco Sangha, at Seattle University. And then I also know the Shin Buddhist priest there at the Seattle Temple, Reverend Castro. So they invited me and I spoke there. I had a wonderful time. And then just 2 weekends ago, I spoke at Mary Washington University, south of Washington, D.C. And so now, this weekend, I'm able to be here. And just before I came here, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at the University of Oregon, I'm not teaching this term, we have a quarter system, but I had 6 hours of meetings a day for 3 days. At the end of those 3 days, I could barely stand. In the midst of all this, when I went to Seattle, a member of the temple, Gail Kaminishi, and her husband, Renan Jeffries, they hosted me at their home, just as Steve and Laura have been so generous in hosting me at their beautiful home. So Gail and Renan have two daughters, and they're all grown, and they're out of the house. And so they let me stay in one of their daughters' rooms. Very generous. And and they had a full-length mirror. They have a full-length mirror in the bedroom. So I was ready to go to sleep, and I took off my clothes. And we don't have a full-length mirror in our house. Or we have one in our closet, but you know, I don't really use it very much. And I looked in the mirror. Now, I probably weigh about maybe 4 or 5 pounds more than I did when I was a college student. So not that much more, considering how many decades have passed. Thank you. And I looked in the mirror. In my underwear. And I thought, not bad. And then I proceeded into the bathroom. And above the sink, they have a very large, you know, almost like wall covering mirror. And I was crestfallen because I just didn't look as slender and fit in the bathroom mirror. And then I suddenly realized the full-length mirror they had in the bedroom, it was a slightly distorting mirror and made me look much more thin and fit than I actually was. So, you know, this is the delusion. This is the confusion that we live with on a daily basis. This is happening all the time. I got on the plane in Eugene, and then I had checked the schedule, see how much connecting time. I was due to arrive at Denver Airport at 9. My next flight's at 10. Denver Airport's a pretty big airport, so I said to myself, just make sure that when you get there, you know, don't waste time, don't go shopping or something. Just go straight to the next gate because you don't have that much time. Well, I fell fast asleep. My first flight, I got off, and I arrived. And I arrived at gate B85. And it said, I checked the board, my next flight's gate B20. So I thought, great, it's the same terminal. It can't be that far. And I'm walking and walking. I'm thinking, I don't remember this part of the Portland airport. It's really taken me a long time. Yeah. And I thought, well, I'm thirsty, so I'm gonna stop and get something to drink. So I got something to drink. But then I said, yeah, it's 8:20 and my next flight's at 10. So I still have time, but I don't think you should stop and grab a meal. you should probably go on to the gate. So it's a good thing, because it wasn't 8:20 at all, and I wasn't even in Portland. It was 9:20, and I was in Denver. So this is happening all the time. I'm reminding myself before I get on my Eugene flight that, you know, don't waste time because you only have an hour. But no, there I am in Denver, and I'm thinking I'm in Portland. Just like the chanting this morning, I forget. But whatever path I found, I knew it had to be that which incorporates my delusions, my confusions, things that I label arbitrarily, failure or unhappiness, especially unhappiness, especially things that I blame other people about, all these things. So one of the points that I think that Shin Buddhism and Zen Buddhism share is this embrace of human confusion, human delusion, and what in Shin Buddhism we call blind passion. Right? Nothing wrong with desire. There's a Zen saying, exchange, you all have heard, those of you in the Zen tradition. Disciple asks the master, "Master, what is enlightenment? Sleep when you're sleepy, eat when you're hungry." Right? Nothing wrong with desire. But that statement's so simple, but so difficult. Right? Because when I'm hungry, I tend to eat too much. Right? Or I'm counting calories. I'm not actually eating, I'm counting calories. Or I'm distracted. Or I'm worrying about the next thing. I'm not really present eating. So, nothing wrong with desire, but we should be in rhythm with our desires, appropriately. But oftentimes, we start to lose, we get off kilter, we get off balance. And so, in Shin Buddhism, we call that blind passions. The problem arises when passions are blind. And yet, reality and the flow of reality has a way of gently, gently reminding me to come back home, to come back into the present. Not to create even bigger problems by blaming myself or blaming other people. Oh, I'm smarter than that. That shouldn't have happened to me. And don't get upset. But to realize that that's all just naturally a part of being a human being. It is much more difficult when we make what we consider to be a bigger mistake, right? But Shin Buddhism, on the one hand, says, as does all of Buddhism, karmically, whatever seeds we sow, we're going to have to live with the consequences. We do something that hurts someone's feelings, and they get angry, it's going to come back. But at the spiritual level, let's not make the problem worse by saying, "Oh, I'm such a bad person," or "He or she is such a bad person." But by realizing this is part of what it means to be a human being. Yeah. So interesting. By and large, I'm very fortunate. University of Oregon is a great place to work, and I get along with my colleagues. But of course, there are going to be times when we have disagreements and sometimes heated discussion. And, you know, you get this feeling, oh, the person doesn't like me because of the view that I hold or something I did. And maybe inadvertently I said something that hurt another person's feelings. What are you going to do? You can't rush out and say, "I'm going to fix it." A lot of times the right situation doesn't pose itself. To continue to blame myself also, this is not helpful. It's not productive. Then how can we be embraced in our anger, in our disappointments, and our problems in such a way that these become fertilizer for deeper wisdom and deeper compassion? And this is what in Shin Buddhism we call the working of boundless compassion. Boundless compassion. Last year at the University of Oregon, on May 10th, 2013, we hosted His Holiness the Dalai Lama. This was a project that took was 9 years in the making, and was not my project, but a local Tibetan group approached me and said, we'd really like to bring the Dalai Lama to the University of Oregon, and we're going to have a meeting with representatives of the Office of the President, and could you come, because you have both, you're both, you know, a professor with an understanding of the university, but you're also a Buddhist and ordained, so maybe you can help us. I said, okay. I went, met with a special assistant to the president named Barbara West. And the Tibetan group, and they had some other people helping them, they said, okay, well, we want to brainstorm. I thought, no, you don't take time from the president's office. I said, this is never going to happen. So after the meeting, I said, look, there's some things I want to try to explain to you about the university. And so 3 or 4 times a year, I met with them over 8 years. And to make a long story short, in the fall of 2012, in September, we finally got a notice from the Office of Tibet in New York saying His Holiness has decided May 10th will be the date. Well, for such a major event, where we're going to use our brand new basketball arena, state-of-the-art facility that holds 12,000 people, with all the security and the State Department, everything involved, you usually want 2 years, but no, we had 9 months. So I met with the senior assistant to the president, Dave Hubin. I said, all right, Dave. Partially they asked me to get involved because I had met the Dalai Lama twice before and had been part of the events. I said, these are all the things we're going to do, everything from logistics to budget. And then I was ready to step back because I knew it was just going to be a full-time job. So I said, okay, I can be a consultant. They said, no. You are central to this. You have to chair the committee. I said, no, I don't think I could do that. They said, you don't have a choice. It's coming from the president. I said, oh, yes, sir. It almost killed me. And I knew what the problems were going to be. We're a state university. We're a secular institution. We're a billion-dollar corporation. We're serving students. The Tibetan group, for them, this is the most important religious event in this small group's entire existence, and it's a life or death moment for them. And they're expecting me to represent them, and the university is expecting me to represent the university's interests. And one thing about the Dalai Lama is different from virtually any other speaker or event, is all hell breaks loose because everybody wants to be able to say, I met the Dalai Lama and I'm his buddy. So I thought, I don't want to deal with this. It's just going to be such a mess. And sure enough, it was so difficult. And I knew I had to bring everyone together. So we're meeting so many hours a week. Provosts and vice presidents and the leaders of the Tibetan Buddhist group. And I knew, I didn't say it, but I knew. I said, look, we have to come together. Because when the Dalai Lama comes, if we're fighting with each other, he's going to know, and he's going to be disappointed. Right? So how am I going to do this impossible thing? So far apart in culture, so far apart in mission. But everybody worked really, really, really hard. And we had our last Friday meeting a week before the event itself. And there was about 40 people in the room, including all the people from the Tibetan Buddhist group, from the university, including university police, city police, athletic department, because they run this massive arena. And I do this with every class I teach. I do this at the Berry event. I hope we'll have an opportunity today. I said, okay, this is our last meeting. Now, everybody just take a moment to say anything you'd like to say about this event. And every single person became very emotional and said, this has been such an amazing process and such a privilege. Even the athletic department representative, who usually only deals with football players, became very emotional. And then it came time for the lawyer to speak, because we have to have legal counsel, so university legal counsel. And he was the one who gave us the hardest time. He says, nope, you can't do this. Nope, you can't do that. Oh, just impossible. And he said, you know, it's been such an honor and privilege to be part of this process that even if he didn't come, I feel it would have been worth it. Yeah, it was amazing. And when the Rinpoche spoke from the Tibetan Buddhist group, he said, I realize I must practice more. So basically, you know, you're living with these people for 9 months. It's just a constant tug of war. All these hard feelings come out. People say things. It's a lot of, you know, there was a lot of upset as well as cooperation. And finally I spoke at the end. I said, well, it's been remarkable for me also to be included in this process. And that's because His Holiness the Dalai Lama has been with us the entire time. And each of us knew we could not fail him. So it was his spirit that made each of you and each of us rise above ourselves and come together in this moment. But it isn't the spirit, it didn't begin with Tenzin Gyatso, the 14th Dalai Lama, no. No, he himself is inspired by his teachers and those teachers, their teachers. Ultimately going all the way back to the Buddha himself. And that's what brought all of us together. And that we wouldn't have it any other way. We're only having this moment of profound appreciation because of our humanity, because of all these limitations we have. And that this moment in which we can feel the presence of the Dalai Lama and feel the compassion of the Buddha himself is precisely because we have all of these blind passions that made us fight with each other over the Tibetan Buddhist group should get more tickets. No, this is for the students. But finally we came and met in the middle way. So our Shin tradition is the embrace of blind passion. And we call the person of blind passion the foolish being. So I, Mark Uno, am number one foolish being. Number one foolish being. But precisely because of that, am embraced in the flow of boundless compassion. It's like the Buddha notices there's just one child. It's like the teacher who notices there's one child who seems out of place and out of sorts and feels insecure. And of all of the students in the class, the teacher is not concerned, doesn't have to pay attention to the students who are capable and pass all of the exams easily. The teacher's attention goes to the one student who is incapable, who's having a hard time, who's having difficulty. All the great teachers I had when I was with them made me feel like I was the only one in the universe. And in Shin Buddhism, our way of expressing that is that the manifestation of the deep flow of the oneness of reality, which we call boundless compassion, or the awakening of infinite light, or in personified terms, Amida Buddha, the Buddha of infinite light, sees only me, and sees especially that part of me that I myself have greatest difficulty with, and say, no, only you, you are the one, you are the one I love, you are the one I embrace. But that boundless compassion, that flow of the oneness of reality, is not some being out there, no, but is the deepest reality of the self calling out to me from the depths of my own being, exactly as you are. Come, and let's walk together. Mr. Ego, I'm your bigger self. Let's do this thing together. And for the first time then, we come into each of us our own, in our own humanity. And only when we have the experience, each of us and each of you, when we have the experience of being fully embraced, exactly as you are, only then are you moved to want to reach out and to truly care about and to be truly curious about and to truly want to get to know each person, every other person, every other creature, a cat, a dog, a gerbil, a bird, an insect, for who she or he truly is. And thereby be immeasurably enriched in my own existence. One of the reasons why I want to go into this profession as to be a teacher, a professor, a priest, is, you know, I enjoy doing research. I enjoy the opportunity to gain new academic knowledge. But it's because I really am interested in people. Each student that comes in front of me, it's like a miracle. It's like when a mother gives birth to a newborn child, and the wonder of that moment of both complete otherness, this gift delivered from the universe, but also this intimacy as if looking into one's own eyes. It's a feeling I have when I see students. But in that encounter, each time, or many times, maybe not every time, but many times, I realize, no, there's something else going on here. I go to my office and I have my proper button-down shirt sometimes, and my blazer, and I'm the professor and you're the student. And I'm the one who's, you know, I've arrived, and this person's still trying to find their way. But I'm made aware of that, not in a bad way, not in a condemning way, but, oh, there you go again. There you go again, being such a professor. And in that moment, I'm released from the prison of my own self-image, and I can move a little bit closer to that student to truly learn to see who has been sent before me, making that micro adjustment in that moment. So this is what we call, so I'll introduce a term of art. You don't actually have to remember these terms of art, but we call this Nishu Jinshin in Japanese. Nishu Jinshin, the two types of deep entrusting. Two types of deep entrusting. One is the deep entrusting of the foolish being. The other is the deep entrusting of boundless compassion. The deep entrusting of the foolish being is to trust that, yes, In fact, I am this foolish being. And that fact is affirmed, not negated. I do something stupid, but Mark, that's just your label. Don't you see? That's your humanity. That's actually your treasure. That's actually the precious fertilizer for your deeper realization. But that only occurs simultaneously with the other deep entrusting, which is the deep entrusting of boundless compassion and infinite light. Because I'm only able to be gently affirmed and realized in my foolishness in the limitless generosity and flow of the deep oneness of reality that illuminates me with limitless life, that embraces me in boundless compassion, that immerses me in the ocean of light. And this is the simultaneous realization of the deep entrusting of foolish being and the deep entrusting of boundless compassion, realized in the saying of the name, Namo Amida Butsu. So this is what we're chanting in the initial chanting, the second section. An elided form of Namo Amida Butsu, which originally is a transliteration from the Sanskrit Namo Amitabha Buddha. Namo Amitabha Buddha. Amitabha Buddha means the Buddha of infinite light. But since Buddha here signifies the dynamic unfolding of the depths of my own reality, that's why I like to call it awakening, because it's dynamic rather than some static being which doesn't really exist. And it's the illumination, it's the clarity and illumination that comes from being brought back into sync with the flow of reality. The awakening of infinite light, illuminating, embracing, and dissolving the hard edges of the foolish being that is myself, filled with blind passion, expressed as the Namu, or the Namo, which comes from the Sanskrit Namas, as in namaste. So namaste means I bow to you. Te is you, namas is bow. So the namo of Namo Amida Butsu comes from the namas of namaste, I bow. In bowing, I simultaneously acknowledge my foolishness and I give up my foolishness, because I give up my whole self to the flow of reality, of the deep flow of oneness, of boundless compassion, of the ocean of light. So Namo Amida Butsu means I, this foolish being filled with blind passion, am embraced, am illuminated, embraced, and dissolved into the ocean of light of boundless compassion. So in a nutshell, that is the Shin teaching. It is the Shin path. To always be affirmed doesn't negate karmic consequences. I had a big heated discussion with a colleague of mine over the phone, because she was part of the effort to unionize our faculty. And I didn't know this is the way things work, but when people do drive for unionization, it's almost like a religious conversion. She says, either you're for us or against us. I said, but you're in the philosophy department. Isn't there some more nuanced, you know, discussion? It's like, you know, I'm not against the union, but I'm not necessarily for it. And I'll tell you why, because the average salary of a professor at the University of Oregon is higher than the median family income in Oregon. So I just don't buy this idea that we have to unionize because you're a member of the proletariat. We're not working class, hello. So I'm just not going to buy that, right? There are other reasons it's necessary to unionize. But I said, I think there are merits. I think, you know, but I think there are some limitations. So I'm just going to wait, bide my time, and, you know, I'm not going to sign the union card now. But she was just really on her horse about this, and she had her reasons, and her father was a union organizer. So I think she was kind of, you know, felt that inspiration and even maybe, you know, duty to carry on the family tradition. But I said, I refuse. And so she didn't even know me. And this is the only extended conversation we ever had. And now we've had a falling out. I can't even have a falling out with somebody I don't really know. But she would. I said, hi, Bonnie, in the elevator. She wouldn't even say hello. I thought, what's up with that? But how many people in this room have never had an experience in their life where they get upset at somebody and you think, I'm never going to talk to that person again? How many people have never had that experience? Everybody's had that experience, right? So I'm thinking, well, she's having this experience. And I'm thinking, but this is unreasonable. And it's like work. Fortunately, one of the reasons why I moved to the University of Oregon, I taught at a small liberal arts college, which is an excellent school, but I don't want to see the same 140 people every single day. Bigger university, you can kind of pick the group of people you want to associate with. But still, you know, she would work in the same building. I have to see her every once in a while. It's kind of uncomfortable. On my part, I have the reaction to that, right? Which is, we need to be able to talk face-to-face, because, I mean, this has happened over the phone. And you need to understand how unreasonable you were and all these things that I'm helping with your department. That's what I want to tell her. But having been immersed in this teaching of boundless compassion, one of the effects of it is to realize, well, she's a fool, but Mark, you're a fool. Two fools, you know, two fools do not, it's like two wrongs do not make a right. Two fools do not make a wise man. So let's not add fuel to the fire. So also drawing on my own experience when I said, I'm never going to talk to him again, right? But then over time, right, that feeling fades. And we're looking for that opening. That's who we are. That's our deeper impulse as human beings. We have all these limitations, all these hard edges, all these peculiarities, but deep down inside, this is what we've come to discover. The deeper we go within, is we have this deeper illumination within us. Before we chop the world into pieces with our fancy concepts that end up turn out to be sharp edges with which we injure ourselves, before we create this artificial world of separation, we're all in it together. It's all one reality. And we start to feel this arising within us. And it loosens our grip on, I'm never going to talk to him again. So I realized, no, Mark, don't be aggressive in return. That's not going to help. Just be gentle as the Buddha within is gentle with you. Just be gentle as the Buddha within is gentle with you. So I didn't force it. I would just wait my time. And if I found an opening, we happened to be near each other in the same lecture. I'd say, hi, Bonnie. Hi. It's kind of casual. Hi. And then one of our mutual colleagues in philosophy didn't know that whether we had interacted or not. A good friend of mine who's a outgoing department head of philosophy, Ted says, oh, Mark, do you know Bonnie? And Mark, Bonnie, do you know Mark? And Bonnie says, oh, I know Mark. And I think, oh, not again, because you don't know me. That's my feeling. You don't know me. And you think you know me because I refuse to sign my union card. That's so unfair, right? But again, it's like, let's not get on that horse again. No, no, no. Just give her space, give her time, right? It's like, well, at least she said hi this time, right? It's better than the silent treatment, especially it's kind of awkward in the elevator. Hi. So then I saw her again. Just a couple days ago at the department heads meeting for the College of Arts and Sciences. And I arrived a little bit late, so there's limited seats. And so the seat next to Bonnie was open, so I sat down next to her. And you know, I have my transcendental powers. Dogen talks about the six divine transcendence or the six divine powers, right? So I have my reading mind's power on, right? and so Ted's supposed to be there to represent the philosophy department, but a couple times Bonnie has come. And I was actually on her review. One of the things I wanted to tell her was, I was on your review committee and how hard I fought for your case to get tenure. Right? She does feminist philosophy and fighting for her as a woman and all these things, but I can't say these things, right? So anyway, but because of that, reviewing her file and knowing certain things, I knew probably she's going to be the next department head. And now that this is Ted's final year, and he's sending her in his steed, right, then more than likely she's going to be the next department head. So I said, hi, Bonnie. This time it's just, again, a little bit softer. Hi. And then I said, oh, are you going to be the next department head? She says, yeah. I says, well, congratulations and condolences. And she says, yeah, thanks. Because that's the joke around department heads. It's the only position that you're promoted for where you say condolences, because it's such a difficult job, right? But it's just to break the ice that way. And our departments have worked together because we often hire their students as our teaching assistants. And me especially, because I have a more philosophical bent than a lot of my colleagues. In fact, I'm an affiliate member of the philosophy department, and I can be the primary advisor for the graduate students. So I work with them a lot. And Bonnie kind of knows this. So I'm trying to find that opening, right? And I really need to tell her, don't you understand how hard I fought for you and how I fought for the causes that you really care about? And you're just going to judge me on the fact that I wouldn't sign a stupid card. But no, the Buddha within is saying, no, Mark. You know, she's just a foolish being, just like you. Just be gentle. So I just leaned over. I said, Bonnie, you know, if you have some time, could we meet briefly? Because, you know, we've had a lot of your graduate students as our teaching assistants, and I'm working with a number of them. She says, oh, yeah, that'd be great. Right? That's the only thing. That'd be great. And part of that is because, as department head, she has to look out for her graduate students. And when there's not enough positions available for her students, then she's going to be looking to our department. But this is the way it goes, right? This is the way it goes. This is the gentle hand of the Buddha within, acting upon us. So, Shin Buddhism is very simple. It's this dynamic. Form and emptiness. The world of language and multiplicity and oneness. But Shin Buddhism doesn't start there. Shin Buddhism starts where the problems are already taken into account. So instead of saying person in cosmic oneness or emptiness, we begin with foolish being, because that's where we are. That's where you are. That's where I am. Filled with attachments, filled with blind passions. We just start with the problem together with the solution already. This is the meaning of the central practice of Shin Buddhism. Namo Amida Butsu is an affirmation of the simultaneous realization of foolish being filled with blind passion and the embrace of boundless compassion. And that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where I discover my own humanity truly and my own uniqueness truly, and come into my own truly and begin to feel comfortable in my own skin so that I can connect with Bonnie, with my cat, with my wife, right? In every long-term relationship, the greatest teacher is always the wife. She's the one who exposes the foolish being most. So it's a very simple practice, very simple teaching, but gets applied over and over and over. In the Shobogenzo, Dogen's greatest work. In the Genjo Koan chapter, which is arguably the most famous chapter, originally written for a lay person who asked Dogen for the essence of the Buddhist teachings, in the first paragraph of the Genjo Koan, so I could read the whole first paragraph, but I'll just begin with the third line of the first paragraph, right? The Buddha way is originally beyond fullness and lack. Thus, there are birth and death, delusion and enlightenment, deluded sentient beings, and enlightened Buddhas. So, there's always some unexpected turn that comes up in the great Buddhist teacher's teachings. But to say the Buddha way is beyond fullness and lack is simply to say it's beyond categorization. It's beyond words. It's the true reality, shorn of all the artificialities of language. So it's the realization of emptiness. It's the realization of oneness. And only when we truly realize the deeper level of connection, oneness, are we truly ready to receive reality in the world of appearances, to truly see and sense and feel that life is real, that death is real, that delusion is real, that enlightenment is real. Because of being brought to life in the dynamic flow of existence from moment to moment, in which one is not better than the other, just like there isn't better zazen and worse zazen. Deluded zazen is zazen, and seemingly enlightened zazen is zazen. And it's only when you realize a zazen that is both enlightened and deluded, and neither enlightened nor deluded, because of being oneness, is that true zazen. When we say Namu Amida Butsu, there isn't better Namu Amida Butsu and worse Namu Amida Butsu. Namu Amida Butsu is Namu Amida Butsu! Foolish being is always foolish being. And great compassion is always great compassion. Always great compassion. So Dogen is saying, only in the true realization of oneness does all of reality come to life. It's a great, great statement. But then he immediately follows that. And he says, despite all this, still, flowers fall amid our sorrow and weeds flourish in our chagrin. So when I first read this, I thought, huh? It's like after this great philosophical statement of profound Buddhist truth of Dharma, he says, well, after all this, I'm just an ordinary human being and I'm still attached to the beautiful flowers and I hate the weeds. And I can relate. We don't use, we have a very natural yard. No lawns, I hate lawns. Natural yard. It's spring. It's warm. It's the dandelion swarm. So we don't use, Roundup or any kind of our chemicals. So there I am, or the day before, pulling up the weeds and so on and so forth. And when I was in Japan, I lived in a Zen temple, Ryokoin, which is one of the great sub-temples of Daitokuji, which is one of the five great houses of Zen in Kyoto, right? So it was amazing. I mean, it was classed as a national treasure. And I had a great, great Zen master, Kobori Nande, who is one of my great, great, dear, dear teachers. And everything there is organic. And I didn't know before I signed up to live in the place where we're doing more cleaning and weeding than any kind of zazen, that's the real practice. So, there I am weeding away. And then, of course, we don't get to use mosquito repellent. In Japan, it's hot and humid and humid. So I lost count of the mosquito bites at like 62. Hello. It's just horrible. Horrible. And I'm weeding and weeding and weeding so much. And finally, when I hit the deck to fall asleep and I close my eyelids, literally, there's just a projection of millions of weeds. That's all I see. So I don't think that it was just a thought experiment that Dogen said, despite all this, still flowers fall amid our sorrow and weeds flourish to our chagrin. No, that's his experience, right? But what does that mean? Does that mean he's just an ordinary person after all? Yes, it means he's an ordinary person after all. You know, there's this Dogen that you've seen all of the drawing of. And there's this Dogen. But no, that's not all. That's not all. One of my other teachers, who many of you know, is Shohaku Okumura. So there's a long story about Shohaku-san. He actually started at Valley Zendo in Western Massachusetts, where my father was his visa sponsor. But when I went to study in Japan in my 20s, I was looking for a place to do monthly seishin. And I went to this place, and then he turned out to be there. So it was like a mutual surprise, and I went to do monthly seishin there for like 2.5 years. And then, when I got my job at Carleton College in Minnesota, he had moved to Minnesota. And Minnesota Zen Center has another center in southern Minnesota. And so I went to do a seishin there for 3 days. If you think the mosquitoes in Kyoto are better, oh my God, you should try southern Minnesota. They call the mosquito the state bird in Minnesota. And in the Rinzai tradition, during Kinhin walking meditation, we run. Yeah, I used to go to Mount Baldy, where the now controversial Sasaki Roshi is the abbot. And I mean, you know, we just run and run and run. I mean, it was grueling up at Mount Baldy. But not in the Soto tradition. In the Soto tradition, it's like slow motion. You know what that's like when you're being swarmed by mosquitoes? Oh my God. It's like there was Shohaku-san. He was just, it was like there was steel in his spine. Yeah. And I believe Dogen was like that. But it's not that he wasn't bothered. He wasn't impervious. No. But he could say that. Despite all of this, still, flowers fall amid our grudging and weeds flourish in our chagrin. Because he's being illuminated by the larger Dharma, what we call boundless compassion in the Shin tradition, Dogen calls Buddha nature. But Buddha nature isn't just an abstract concept. The Buddha nature is the dynamic unfolding of the great oneness of the universe itself, empowered by the inexorable force of the universe itself. Mosquito bites nothing. It's all about coming home to the present self, which is not enlightened. That's my immediate experience of my reality. I shouldn't even go there, but well, when I was a teenager, my hair was so thick, and Asian hair tends to be thicker than Westerners' hair. My hair was so thick, I mean, each strand was so thick, that I looked like I had a straight-haired afro when I looked at myself when I was like 15 or 16. So my hair started thinning probably when I was in my 20s. It's just been a gradual decline. One thing really, really great about going bald, in most cases, maybe not some other cases, but certainly in my case, is it's the gradual, it's the path of the gradual teaching. It gives you plenty of time to get used to its ins and outs. So I don't do this anymore, but when I first started noticing the balder spot up here, I used to start sitting at the back of the bus so that less people could see my bald spot. Now I catch myself. It's so funny because it's all kind of subconscious. Now I catch myself every once in a while when I'm looking in the mirror for looking for that angle that makes me look like I have more hair. So this is the foolish being, but you see, all of this becomes, it's all good stuff when we realize this is my humanity, but in a good way, in a good way. Do we need a 5-minute break? Yes. All right, 5-minute break. So palms together.